Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, January 20th. On Joe Biden's 365th day in office, at least three significant things happened. One had nothing to do with Joe Biden. The Supreme Court ruled that Donald Trump does have to comply with a congressional subpoena for documents pertaining to the January 6th insurrection, and that understanding what happened that day is more important than any claim to executive privilege that Trump was asserting. Only one justice, Clarence Thomas, wrote in dissent. So last night, it's being reported, the National Archives gave the committee hundreds of pages of White House documents it was holding. Eventually, we'll know if they shed any meaningful light. The second significant thing that happened yesterday was that the Senate, as expected, failed to advance voting rights legislation blocked by all 50 Republicans, plus Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. And the third thing, Biden Day 365 was the day that he held an end of his first year in office news conference that, as much as anything, was a two-hour-long pushback against the media narrative and public perception in many places that year one has not been a great success. Here is the first question asked by a reporter at the beginning of the president's news conference, and we'll also hear the beginning of his response.
Thank you, Mr. President. I know some of my colleagues will get into some specific issues, but I wanted to zoom out on your first year in office. Inflation is up. Your signature domestic legislation is stalled in Congress. In a few hours from now, the Senate, an effort in the Senate to deal with voting rights and voting reform legislation is going to fail. COVID-19 is still taking the lives of 1,500 Americans every day. And the nation's divisions are just as raw as they were a year ago. Did you overpromise to the American public what you could achieve in your first year in office? And how do you plan to course correct going forward?
Why are you such an optimist? Look, I didn't overpromise. But I have probably outperformed what anybody thought would happen. The fact of the matter is that we're in a situation where we have made enormous progress. You mentioned the number of deaths from COVID. Well, it was three times that not long ago. It's coming down. Everything's changing.
President Biden, near the start of his nearly two-hour news conference yesterday afternoon. And with us now are Jamil Smith, senior correspondent at Vox and co-host of the podcast Vox Conversations. Some of his recent pieces or interviews are on Robert Bullard, known as the father of the environmental justice movement, why Fannie Lou Hamer's definition of freedom still matters, and on what he called the ironic spectacle of Kyle Rittenhouse's appearance on Tucker Carlson. Also with us, Amanda Carpenter, political columnist at The Bulwark, the news organization made up largely of anti-Trump conservatives. Carpenter is author of the book Gaslighting America, Why We Love It When Trump Lies to Us, and has previously served as a speechwriter to South Carolina Senator Jim DeMint and communications director to Senator Ted Cruz up to 2015. Before going to Capitol Hill, she worked as a reporter for the conservative-leaning news organizations Human Events, Townhall.com, and The Washington Times. Hi, Jamil. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So we played that clip of the first reporter question, framing progress not made during Biden's first year as president, and the beginning of Biden's answer that in which he referred to his progress on COVID. That was just the start of that answer. So let me get each of your big picture takes first, just in terms of how successful you think Biden has been on COVID public health and the COVID economy, not just as an absolute, but compared in real life to how else he might have done given the state of the country when he took office. Jamil, would you start?
Yes. I think that, first of all, I think the question was stated in a way that I think frames things a little bit narrowly. I think, you know, success.
You mean the reporter's question in the clip?
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think that the reporter's question certainly, you know, frames things as if, you know, everything just kind of went to hell. And, you know, I think certainly, you know, the president's response, you know, saying that, okay, yes, you know, 6.4 million jobs were created. Well, yes, you know, we're kind of working within this old paradigm of, you know, well, you know, job creation and inflation, all these kind of things that worked in a world where we didn't have a pandemic that none of us had ever seen before. And we have to kind of reorganize our thinking. And within this kind of new COVID world, you know, supply chain economics are different. And, you know, unemployment rates should be viewed differently. Labor shortages should be viewed differently. And so, frankly, I think really there's just a lack of confrontation on both the side of the press and, frankly, the president in terms of how do we confront this new world and in these new challenges, you know, not trying to restore what was, but understanding what, frankly, is. You know, we're talking, you know, about what Dr. Fauci was mentioning recently about how this is, you know, possibly going to become endemic. This is a reality we're going to be have to get used to, have to live with. And if we're going to have, if that's actually true, how do we adjust? How do we adjust America to understand this reality? And how do we think about numbers in a new way? So it's tough to evaluate any president after 1 year. I mean, think about if we tried to do that to President Obama after, you know, during the Great Recession, with job numbers sinking in the first year. But my point is, how do we think about this new world? And this is not a recession. This is a pandemic. This is something that we're all suffering from in various ways, and we may have to suffer from for years to come.
And endemic is an interesting word that we're going to tackle in more depth on tomorrow's show. It's good in the sense that it's not a pandemic anymore, but it's bad in the sense that it's kind of permanent what there will be if endemic is what comes about. Amanda Carpenter, same question.
Well, I did like the framing of the reporter's question because there's so much going on and you have to set the table for the president to respond, which he did over 2 hours. But this idea that we need to settle into a permanent COVID mindset, that is most definitely not what President Biden campaigned on and was not the expectation from the American people. I think it wasn't a matter of whether Biden overpromised, but did he understand what he was elected to do? In my view, as a sort of never Trump conservative, Biden was elected to, number one, not be Trump and restore some sense of normalcy and credibility and certainty to the government, and also crush COVID, get us out of this pandemic. And the latter did not happen. And I understand it's not completely within Biden's control, but guess what? Presidents have to deal with a lot of unexpected, unfair circumstances. And there are many ways in which he fundamentally misunderstood what was going on here. We've had two new variants. And above all, the lack of communication coming from the administration on COVID is what is extremely frustrating when it comes to just basically living, whether you have kids in school, you're dealing with unemployment, the economy. And he should take credit. The economy is sort of doing okay. But if you're a family, even if you have some money, if you can't go spend it, if you can't go places, if you can't give normally, you're going to think the economy is doing extremely poorly. And so it's good that he's out there talking, but he can't just do this sort of once-a-year press conference and go out for 2 hours, check the box, and say that he's done. And I'm going to say something that sounds a little bit crazy here. He needs to be more like Trump. He needs to be holding press conferences with the doctors on a daily basis. Tell us where we're going, how we get these masks off, what are the metrics, how do we get back to normal? Because what I'm hearing proposed that we just have to settle into this permanent malaise, the American people are never going to accept that.
Jamil, want to continue?
Sure. I definitely think that the American people need to kind of come to grips with it. I mean, listen, I think the American people have come to grips with a lot of different realities over the course of the history of this country. And I think, you know, I think we would be wrong in underestimating what we as a people can, in fact, make adjustments to. And I think that, yes, the president could offer a reassuring presence if he, in fact, you know, did do pressers. And I agree with Amanda wholeheartedly that the communication from, especially from the CDC, has been absolutely abhorrent. and has been one of the major failings of this administration with regards to just really showing the efficacy of government. And I think one of the main things I do think that Biden was elected to do was to show how governance can work, especially in the wake of such an incompetent administration. You have to show that governance is a thing, is that governance can actually be, you know, can the presidency can actually function. And when it doesn't function in a really elemental and easy way, then, you know, you have people starting to doubt, and you've got people wanting to sort of, you know, satiate their feelings with their votes rather than actually put in people who are effective. And that's how we end up with
I think Amanda's saying it could have functioned more better than Trump under Biden.
Yeah, I guess my point is if the Democrats, let me agree with Jamil just a little bit here. If the Democrats want to be the party of government, they have to show that it works. And I think this is best illustrated with the feeling of just getting testing done. Number one, it was good what the Trump administration did to get Operation Warp Speed in effect, to really to have the multiple shots on the goal strategy to get the vaccines going. Biden deployed it. Great. Good job, everyone. But on the testing, you know, this pandemic started in 2020. It is now 2022, and we still don't have our arms around free, easy, cheap testing. You know, it seems to me the party that wants to have universal health care and all these things, they should be able to execute on testing. Other countries do it. There is models to follow. I'm glad we're finally getting them, maybe in the mail at the end of January. But this is not a good illustration of government competency.
Next, I'm going to play three more clips of Biden from the news conference on COVID public health and the COVID economy. Here he is answering a question about inflation in terms of his Build Back Better safety net bill, which he doesn't currently have the votes for in the Senate.
My Build Back Better plan will address the biggest cost of working families face every day. No other plan will do more to lower the cost for American families. It cuts the cost for childcare. Many families, including the people sitting in this room, if they have children and they're working full time, many families pay up to $14,000 a year for childcare in big cities, less than that in smaller ones.
So there's that. He also made a centerpiece of his news conference criticizing Mitch McConnell and the Republicans for not even having a solutions agenda, only trying to make sure he, Biden, is unsuccessful as kind of mindless gamesmanship from the Republican side of the aisle. Here's Biden on that.
What are Republicans for? What are they for? Name me one thing they're for. And so the problem here is that I think what's happens, what I have to do in the change in tactic, if you will, I have to make clear to the American people what we are for. We've passed a lot. We passed a lot of things that people don't even understand what's all that's in it, understandably.
Biden came back to that, definitely a midterm elections theme, number of times. Here's one more where he admits he'll have to try to get smaller pieces of his Build Back Better bill passed separately. The original, as many of you know, included child care, universal pre-K, paid family leave, elder care supports, free community college, climate protection measures, and some other things too. Listen to what he said yesterday.
I'm confident we can get pieces, big chunks of the Build Back Better law signed into law. And I'm confident that we can take the case to the American people that the people they should be voting for who are going to oversee whether the elections, in fact, are legit or not, should not be those who are being put up by the Republicans to determine that they're going to be able to change the outcome of the election.
Some more of the president from yesterday's news conference as we continue with Jamil Smith from Vox and Amanda Carpenter from The Bulwark. Amanda, for you as a former staffer for Senate Republicans, do you agree with Biden that the Republicans have no solutions agenda for COVID or the economy and only care about blocking anything Biden might try to accomplish, even if it's good for the country?
Well, I would certainly look to the new governor in Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, for the model of what solutions Republicans would like to put forth in terms of COVID and the economy. And it's firmly leaning into the position of getting things back open, lifting the mask mandates in schools, et cetera. I mean, whether people agree with that strategy or not, that is what he is seeking to do there. But if you want to talk about Senate Republicans and what Biden is facing, I understand I'm speaking politically here. There's no reason for the Senate Republicans to push forth an agenda because they are by default winning the argument because the Democrats are fighting themselves constantly. I mean, if you want to talk about why Joe Biden is unable to unify the country, perhaps look at why he's been unable to unify his party. It is his own party that has stepped on the Build Back Better bill and has been unable to message the win that he got on the hard infrastructure part. It is his party that can't come to an agreement of whether they will change the filibuster rules to pursue a voting rights agenda. And so I think he is on the right track in understanding that if he wants to have victories, he needs to pursue smaller items. But at the same time, his party needs to accept what is doable with only a 50-50 Senate, be happy with those victories, message them, and use it as a way to build towards the midterms.
Jamil?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, we're facing increasingly urgent challenges in this world. I mean, climate change has to be solved now. These are things that have to be solved now. We can't accept compromises on how that can be solved or not solved. Voting rights have to be done now. We have to get infrastructure done now. And thankfully, there did manage to be a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that was made into law. We'll see how much that does. And I'm working on a piece on that now. The point is, they have to work on these problems now. And they have to do their very best. And that's what voters elected them to do. I granted, yes, there has to be compromises in politics and all that. But if voters don't see them trying their hardest to get these problems solved at the level at which they need to be solved, why on earth would they show up at the polls, given how hard Republicans are working to keep them from doing that? Why would they work so hard to do that, especially during a pandemic where they're literally risking their lives sometimes to actually vote?
Amanda, go ahead.
Here is something that I think is a fundamental mismatch when it comes to the Republicans and Democrats in a way that really advantages Republicans, and it is unfair. There is the expectation from, I think, too many progressive voters that they have to get things, all the things that they want from President Biden. The most clear example I can think of is that, you know, cancellation of student loan debt. It's my understanding that Biden was never firmly on board with that plan, but a lot of other figures, say Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, were. But the Democratic voters did not pick Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren to be their nominee. They picked Joe Biden. And yet I hear again and again from progressive activists that we're not going to come out and vote for Biden again because he didn't cancel my student loan debt. Now, that is an unfair expectation that Joe Biden has to manage. And then when you contrast that with the Republicans, they're not promising their voters anything. All they are telling their voters is that, hey, we're going to stop Biden and also maybe own the libs along the way. And that is a much easier task to accomplish. No, listen, I'm just being realistic here. I'm not saying it's good. I'm not saying I like it. But this is what Biden's up against. And it's tough.
Yeah, no, but I agree that that's an unfair expectation of those particular voters. But I do agree. I do want to note that Biden did promise to make voting rights a primary push of his presidency. And the words voting rights were not only not in his inaugural address, but they were not a primary push of his presidency until John Lewis died. And then all of a sudden he makes a speech in Wilmington, Delaware, in which he says, okay, well, yeah, now is the time to actually make that push. And by then it's too late.
And we're gonna get more into voting rights in a minute as we pivot from COVID and the COVID economy to Biden and democracy. So we'll come back to that. A couple of more calls on this first section. Caitlin in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Caitlin.
Very long time listener. One of the guests said, you know, Biden, that he was voted into office to crush COVID. And I have to say, I can't understand how that kind of comment or mindset is at all helpful when we have a Supreme Court justice who, when asked to wear a mask, said no, just to a meeting where he sits next to someone who has underlying health issues. Like if a Supreme Court justice won't put on a mask, how on earth can a presidential cabinet, can the administration, you know, be effective on COVID? And you can apply that kind of logic to the Senate, to the House. But anyway, that was my comment.
Caitlin, thank you very much. Yeah, we talked about that on yesterday's show. Justice Gorsuch refusing to wear a mask, reportedly from NPR's Nina Totenberg, when asked by Chief Justice Roberts, the only justice during Omicron reportedly to refuse, and that reportedly that caused Justice Sotomayor, who has diabetes, hence is vulnerable because of an underlying condition, to have to isolate and do Supreme Court meetings virtually. The report was because Gorsuch refused to wear a mask. I see they put out some kind of joint statement asserting their good relationship. I'm just curious, we're digressing a little bit, but because we covered it yesterday and the caller brought it up, Amanda, have you seen this statement from the two justices by any chance?
Yes, I have. Or didn't it come through by way of Chief Justice Roberts saying essentially that they're on good terms now and everything is fine? Do I have that correct?
You know, I would have to look more deeply into it myself. It wasn't really what I prepared for today. But interesting.
I think he's trying to smooth it over.
Yeah, I see. He wasn't saying it didn't happen. Or
Right.
He didn't deny the fact that he asked Gorsuch. But if I'm hearing you right, Jamil, anything to add to that? I'm sorry to be vague on this.
I would just say that it would be nice that if the highest court in our land chooses to issue a statement of that kind, it would be nice that they actually address the facts of the report.
Alan in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering why Biden didn't make two simple points that could have really helped the argument on COVID. First of all, Washington wrote a letter to the troops in, I think, 1775, ordering vaccinations against smallpox when it was just recently available. Nothing against liberty or freedom or patriotism there. It was just common sense, saving the lives of troops so they could fight in battle. Why isn't that the view of people being having lives saved so they can participate in the economy? And the other point I'd want to make is the attitude held by Scalia that seems to be followed by his disciples, the three new Trump appointees. Scalia once said to an audience when he didn't know he was being recorded that, what's the big deal about procedural capital punishment cases that sometimes lead to execution? If people are believing followers of certain faiths, then death is no big deal, he actually said. Now, if people like Gorsuch or Barrett or Kavanaugh believe these things, their goal is not to actually protect life. Their goal is to promote their dogma. And there must be a subtle way of getting across the view that we're basically as a government in favor of life, even if individuals want to pursue a religion that doesn't prioritize it.
Alan, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Before we pivot to Biden and democracy, maybe this actually makes a segue. Jamil, maybe the most embarrassing part of the whole news conference for Biden yesterday was acknowledging that he thought Republicans would be different with him as president than they were when he was vice president under Obama. And McConnell's stated mission, Amanda will give you a chance to say if you disagree, was to make Obama a failed president. What did Biden, with all his Senate experience, misunderstood about what Mitch McConnell and other Senate Republicans would do?
Yes, that was particularly embarrassing. And of course, that was part of his response to the overpromising question at the beginning of the press conference. It goes to, frankly, a feeling that I had, you know, when he was running, was that, you know, is Joe Biden actually prepared to meet this moment? And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with his long experience in the Senate or as vice president. You know, frankly, this is a moment that calls for a particular, you know, kind of politician who's, you know, attuned to, you know, the need for, you know, kind of anti-racism and anti-misogyny and all these different kinds of, you know, urgencies that are needed from a public official, you know, that, you know, also, frankly, someone who's attuned to, you know, the need for getting things done, within our government, and he just seems to prioritize a lot of the kind of big swings at the very beginning, as opposed to starting to hit some singles, and also just kind of I don't understand, frankly, given how Republicans have been engaged in this kind of election subversion throughout various state legislatures and school boards, and engaged in this ridiculous crusade against critical race theory, what they call critical race theory, how he's kind of stood on the sidelines and kind of watched all this happen, and then at the end kind of wants to take a very big swing after John Lewis dies, and then is kind of caught flat-footed and is unprepared for the this kind of stoic stance of Joe Manchin and Kirsten Sinema, who he knew weren't going to change their minds.
Maybe Biden's been watching too much actual baseball lately, where they only try to hit home runs anymore and not singles. But that's another station. Go ahead.
Or he's caught up in his own dogma of this kind of soul of America talk, instead of actually worrying about trying to get things done. And making sure that people's rights are protected. I mean, we need to stop talking about the soul of America, and actually, make sure that people can participate in America.
Here's the president yesterday predicting the Republicans' attempts to make voting harder, especially for people of color, or minorities, as he called them, will fail.
We had the highest voter turnout in the history of the United States of America. Well, I think if in fact, no matter how hard they make it for minorities to vote, I think you're going to see them willing to stand in line and defy the attempt to keep them from being able to. I think you're going to see the people we're trying to keep from being able to show up, showing up and making the sacrifice it needs to be made in order to change the law back to what it should be.
And here's the president answering a reporter's question about many black voters thinking he's only giving lip service to voting rights recently and didn't try hard enough from day one. This came up in our conversation before the break. Here, Biden says he has tried from day one, but
part of the problem is, as well, I have not been out in the community nearly enough. I've been here an awful lot. I find myself in a situation where I don't get a chance to look people in the eye, because of both COVID and things that are happening in Washington, to be able to go out and do the things that I've always been able to do pretty well, connect with people.
And one more clip on this. We talked before the break about the president kind of admitting he miscalculated on being able to get some Republicans on board for some of his agenda items. Well, here he admits he kind of miscalculated on Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema from his own party's willingness to help get something done on voting rights.
And so the idea that I didn't either anticipate, or because I didn't speak to it as fervently as they want me to earlier. In the meantime, I was spending a lot of time, spent hours and hours and hours talking with my colleagues on the Democratic side, trying to get them to agree that if, in fact, this occurred, if this push continued, that they would be there for John Lewis. And anyway,
the president yesterday. So, Jamil, we accidentally, I have to admit, had your mic up during the first clip. And luckily, you didn't say anything that would cause our FCC license to be revoked. But you were clearly not happy when the president was talking about how minorities, as he called them, are going to vote anyway, despite what Republicans do in a bunch of states. What were you thinking? And I apologize, because we should never let that happen.
No, it's perfectly fine. In a way, I'm kind of glad, because it echoes that report from last summer, when it came out of the White House, when they started talking about how, their hopes for, folks were going to out-organize voter suppression. Yeah, I guess that, it's a grand vision, and it's quite a fantasy. But it also sort of abdicates the responsibility of policymaking to people who have been oppressed for generations. It's really easy to say that, oh, well, you go ahead and you folks on the ground, you handle it. You know, there are people out here breaking their necks.
By standing online for hours.
Right. There are people out here breaking their necks to get this policy passed. And they are sending people to Washington and to state houses and to local offices to try to get this kind of policy passed to make sure that the folks who are out here working every day have access to the ballot so that they can participate in democracy. And this president and his White House are talking about, well, you know what? I just really hope that everyone shows up, and that's how we're gonna fight this. That's
Amanda,
an abdication of duty.
Anything on those three clips?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with the notion that Biden should have gone to this earlier. I mean, the amount of time that was spent on infrastructure, I mean, basically a whole year, when there was already $5 trillion in COVID relief money sloshing around between emergency spending conducted by both the Trump and Biden administration in that time at the end of 2020 through the beginning of 2021. They should have been able to make the calculation that there's only so much that is achievable in the 50-50 Senate, got that done, taken the win, and then pivoted quickly to voting rights. I would prefer that voting rights be number one, but that is not the decision that the Biden administration made. And it cost them. It cost them bigly, as Trump would say. And to Jamil's point, the Republicans didn't wait. While Joe Biden was busy negotiating in the backroom deals with Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, Republicans in the states were moving to aggressively restrict voting rights. You know, 30 laws in many states. Arizona conducted a ridiculous audit that took over a year. And the Democrats essentially gave them all a free pass to do it. And that is going to be extremely problematic going into 2022, because this mindset, embracing the big lie, new laws restricting the right to vote based on the big lie, have firmly taken hold. And so I'm not sure how he can recover, but he has to try. This idea that Manchin was going to embrace some kind of rules change and wouldn't be interpreted as nuking the filibuster was kind of silly. But now is the time to start talking to voters in all the states about what rights they should be able to expect from their states in terms of early voting, automatic voting registration, mail-in ballots. The education process has to start early. And I am hopeful that there does seem to be a bipartisan interest in updating the Electoral Reform Act, which would raise the threshold in terms of objections when it comes to certifying the eventual winner and clarifying the role that the vice president should play in that process. Because the Trump folks found out that there were a lot of vulnerabilities there. And they tried their darndest to exploit those vulnerabilities and deprive Joe Biden of the presidency. And it is absolutely urgent that that Electoral Reform Act be updated. That would be a good win, sufficient, but also not enough.
Les in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Les.
Hi. I can't understand why they can't get a carve out to pass the voting rights bill and then reverse the carve out so that there's the full filibuster back intact, so Manchin and Sinema are happy. Why can't they do that?
It's an excellent question for Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. I think that Senator Warnock certainly made an eloquent case for doing just that recently. And yes, and, you know, he made the eloquent case for after they did that for the debt ceiling. You know, they quickly, you know, made the quick carve out and then reinstated the requirement. So, you know, I feel like, you know, Republicans and Democrats alike, unfortunately, have been able to make these kinds of exceptions for wealth and oligarchy, but not for democracy. And we keep seeing that time and time again.
Sienna in Hudson, New York. You're on WNYC. Hi, Sienna.
Hi, good morning. I'm just feeling like the Democratic Party hasn't been using their power to get out in press conferences, and I'm talking about all of our representatives in each of our states, to explain how the Republicans have passed legislation to suppress voters' ability to vote. And I think that a lot of people that aren't facing that problem that they can't necessarily identify that there is a problem. I really don't think the time has been spent to explicitly make clear through facts, through statistics, but also through videos and personal, you know, people's experiences. Get actually the voice of the people who have already been affected out there. And I'd love to see our representatives do more to do so. I wonder what your thoughts are on that, and I can take my the answer offline.
Sienna, thank you. I'm going to bring on a couple of more callers first and then let our guests respond to them all, including you, Sienna. Brian in Atlanta, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a C-SPAN geek. Well, I'm a programmer and an actor, and I watched the entire Senate debate yesterday. And Ossoff, I missed his first comments, but he called out four Republican senators, and one of them was Collins, and she got up and presented it. They had a battering back and forth, and they finished. It was pretty congenial. And then the next senator, I can't remember his name, Democrat, he said, you know, I've been in the Senate for 16 years, and that is the best debate I've ever seen since I've been in the Senate. They do not debate anything in the goddamn Senate. Excuse my language. I think you can cut that out because you got to.
That one's on the okay list. Go ahead.
Okay. We need to force these damn people to discuss the issues.
So you did it again.
They don't want to talk. The Republicans don't want to talk about. Sorry. They don't want to talk about the bill. They want to say they just don't want to talk about it. We need to demand that these people talk about it.
The actual talking. Filibuster
of the voting rights bill. I think this is what it's about. They don't even want to talk about it because they don't want to say, all right, we'll make it so Indians, we don't want them easier ways to vote, or we don't want to talk about seven, which is real in Lowndes County in Georgia, closing six of seven polling places in a rural county. And I'm going to leave with two comments. I've heard one person up at Harvard that was discussing police brutality. And one of his comments was, we need to begin talking about interest rather than positions. And I think that's true with politics. And another one is out of Georgetown, some theologian that said, I don't care about let's stop going left and right and left and right. Let's go deeper.
And Brian, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Call us from Atlanta again and tell us what's happening on C-SPAN. And Peyton in Sunset Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peyton.
Hi. So my question, earlier we spoke more about obstructionism, and my question is, Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed 3,721 executive orders during his presidency, and so far Joe Biden has signed 77. So why is it that this presidency, who needs to win over voters, can't deal with obstructionism by making more of these types of short-term pushes for
Peyton, thank you very
American
much.
People.
And in our remaining time, which is not a lot of time, I want to touch each of those three callers in some way or another. Amanda, to the caller from Georgia who watched that debate on C-SPAN and is frustrated that the Senate, reflecting one of the Democrats who spoke, the Senate doesn't actually hold real debates anymore. For you as a former Senate staffer to two Republican senators in the past, do you think that's true?
I think it's 100% true, which is why I thought maybe the best pathway to moving forward on voter rights was to restore the talking filibuster. The biggest criticism that Joe Manchin is afraid of is saying that essentially he would gut the filibuster, nuke it, well, bring it back. Make that word mean what it is supposed to mean, debate. Right now, the Senate rules, you have to have 60 votes in order to move forward with a bill. Well, why don't you have 60 senators hold the floor talking about it in order to hold it up? Because right now, it favors the minority. There are trade-offs in doing this. It means the Senate would be able to do fewer things. But as long as the majority was able to prioritize what is important, I think voting rights certainly merits that kind of prioritization. I think a talking filibuster would be the way to go. And I think that's sort of what they were trying to demonstrate last night.
Mm-hmm.
But we sure could use a heck of a lot more of it.
And Jamil, to the other two callers, the one from Hudson, New York, who said congresspeople aren't driving the message on voting rights, and to the last caller from Sunset Park, who noted how few executive orders Joe Biden is issuing, can he do anything about voting rights, as far as you're concerned, through an executive order that he's not doing?
Well, I mean, I heard Sherrod Brown, the senator from my home state of Ohio, on the Senate floor yesterday, you know, very loudly and eloquently talking about voting rights. And I actually hope that people go and watch what he had to say. Frankly, I would recommend that the president go watch what he had to say and maybe adopt some of the cadence and urgency of his speech. But I mean, frankly, you know, with regards to presidential orders, I don't know how much speeches or, you know, presidential orders from Washington are going to help ultimately. Executive orders, I mean, heck, there was one in March of last year, executive order on promoting access to voting done by the White House. We see how much that did. So the only thing I can think of right now, perhaps, and I'm not really in the business of giving advice to the president, but, you know, perhaps he or Vice President Harris can start barnstorming the country and start making voters aware of the anti-democratic efforts that Republicans are under, you know, in the midst of or have taken advantage of, you know, over the course of the last couple of years. And that might have an effect on the 2022 midterms, and make sure people are at least aware of what the heck is going on in their states, and make sure that people can, you know, find ways to possibly get involved. That to me is possibly all they can do at this point.
And Amanda, we have 1 minute left, and I'm going to give it to you because I said at the beginning of the hour that we'd get to the Supreme Court ruling last night requiring Trump to give Congress his January 6th related documents. And I see your latest article on the Bulwark is called The Six Main Strands of the Trump Coup Attempt. What are you hoping these January 6th papers reveal in our last minute?
Well, I think the broad thing that I continually try to demonstrate and think this release would was that the strategy to overturn the election was sustained, multi-pronged, deliberate, and serious. It started off, you know, sort of this thing about conspiracies about the rigged election, but it did very quickly build up into a scheme that encompassed all of the Republican elite, the conservative grassroots base, and the militias in America. And that's something that people need to fully understand, and I hope those records shed light on.
Amanda Carpenter from The Bulwark, Jamil Smith from Vox, thank you both so much for joining us and having a great conversation about Joe Biden's news conference yesterday and his first year. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.